Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Chuck Klosterman's new book is I Wear the Black Hat. It is now out in paperback, and as it says on the front cover, now with bonus villainy. I Wear the Black Hat asks in a variety of entertaining and provocative ways, who are the bad guys? Chuck Klosterman is the New York Times bestselling author of 7 previous books, including Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, and Eating the Dinosaur, Killing Yourself to Live, and The Visible Man. It is a great pleasure to welcome Chuck Klosterman back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Hey, it's great to be here. Although I should tell you, I'm talking to you on a telephone in a conference room, and I'm around a rectangular table. Will that cause any problems? Maybe I could sand down the corners.
No, I think it's one of the beauties of radio that if you told us you were at a round table, that we would believe you.
I know, but I'm full transparency. I'm not going to make people think I'm in front of a round table if I'm in front of a square table.
So you're in front of a square table. We are at a rounded table here, so that is fine, and we'll have a round table discussion with just us. So let me ask you about how you came to this idea of who are the bad guys, who wear the black hats, and this idea of villainy.
Well, you know, it's probably less linear than it should be for storytelling purposes. Like, I don't know if I decided, I want to write about villains. I feel like more I wanted to write about certain people. And as I started considering, you know, these different essays I wanted to do, I was like, well, I seem to be dealing with a certain kind of media perception of these people. And I chose the word villainy as sort of the umbrella term. I think more like a better explanation would be that, you know, I just think that as a person matures, how they start perceiving the people sort of described as good and the people described as bad sort of essentially changes. And I'm interested both in why that change occurs and maybe even to a greater degree how arbitrary sort of the final assessments tend to be.
As I should have mentioned in the introduction, although I didn't for a reason, which is why I wanted to spotlight it now, and that is that you are the ethicist for the New York Times Magazine. So in many ways, your barometer, if you will, of coming up with what's good and bad, what is ethical and what is not, is something that you are, I assume, finely attuned to.
Well, I mean, definitely seems like more than a coincidence that I wrote this book when I started doing the ethicist column. I think, you know, I've written 8 books now, and those early ones I was very much consumed with almost consumption-based issues, the consumption of rock music particularly, but also film and sports, and also, you know, drugs and women and these things that were very much grounded in the real experience that was happening to me. But as I got older, I guess I felt my mind drifting toward more of an analysis of my motives for being into those things. What made me want the things that I was so fascinated by, and that just kind of kept going until, like, well, the motives of people in general and how much of our world is real and how much of it is just sort of a construction that we now have totally given the reins over to the media, that our basic understanding of the world now is very distant from the actual experience we're having.
I think one of the things that you discuss in the book quite succinctly and very interestingly is this idea of our memory, of how we think of things. And there is an essay in the book called I Am Perplexed. This is why they hate you. One of the things that you explore in that essay is, what is it about, say, Fred Durst, that we label him a misogynist more frequently than we would somebody like James Taylor or the Rolling Stones? In the case of James Taylor, you say perhaps the worst husband of the 1970s, and the Rolling Stones for many exploits and ideas. Does that have to do with one being more current than the other?
Well, when I read about that in the book, basically the genesis was I was talking at a college. I was giving a lecture at a college, and at the end of it, this kid came up to me, and the kid says to me, "Why do I hate Fred Durst?" And he wasn't asking me. He was saying, "Why did he hate Fred Durst?"
Right.
He was asking me to explain to him why he hates Fred Durst. And of course, my initial reaction is, "It seems like you should be telling me this." And he's like, "No, I want you to tell me." So I start running through all the possible things, you know. But I just realized over and over again that they were so easily contradicted. You know, the things about misogyny or the way that he presents himself or the level of musicianship, any of these things. It is just effortless to basically come out with a counterexample that seems even worse and is seen as 10 times less problematic by that kid or anybody else. And I was kind of pushed to kind of conclude that, well, you know, maybe you don't hate Fred Durst. Maybe you actually really like Fred Durst, or at least you like the experience of feeling as though you're justified in hating him, and that really he's just a way for you to signal to other people what you're like by saying you're not like him, which kind of means he's a pretty important figure in your life. I think that one of the many, you know, many cliches are true, but one very true cliche is that, you know, the opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is indifference. So if you hate something, you're probably closer to caring about them than you'd like to admit.
And how does that manifest itself and ultimately get us in trouble in the sense of, because we're looking for that white hat or black hat, right? We're looking for what is good and bad so we can justify our actions in what I think most of us hope is the good way.
I think maybe a clear illustration of this, I don't know if it necessarily gets us in trouble, but when you look at anywhere in the Western world, America, but really any country like us, how have we been raised to understand anything, whether it's the news or our own life or a novel? It's basically through narrative, through the idea of storytelling, that everything that we consume has to be framed in a way that kind of brings us back to almost the earliest ways we understood stories as little, you know, toddlers or whatever. Now, of course, if you have narrative as an essential part of understanding the world, you're going to need the figures of narrative, which are heroes and villains in action. And we got to jam these people into some of those roles. I mean, if we're talking about whether it's Fred Durst or Newt Gingrich or whoever you want to talk about, in order to understand it, we need to put it into that story. And that story demands that basically half the people we consume are going to be antagonists.
You make the point in the book that as a kid you pulled for Luke Skywalker, but as an adult that you inevitably find yourself relating to Darth Vader. And I think many of us fall into that category. As you age and you mature, you sort of understand things more. And of course, that's a more complex story, as most things are, than are at first sight.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that little section of the book in many ways, it almost worries me because it seems to almost describe the whole book in three paragraphs. Maybe that's all I would have needed to write. But I mean, there is, before I wrote this book, I was talking to my editor about the idea, and his 4-year-old son had just seen the movie Star Wars, and of course it blew his mind. And I was thinking to myself, you know, it seems like little guys, at least, all go through the same evolutionary a trajectory where when they first see a movie like Star Wars or The Empire Strikes Back or Return of the Jedi, they want to be Luke Skywalker. And if they go outside and play Star Wars, they want to be the purely good, totally heroic, almost blindly naive character who very much views the world in a clear way. Then they get into junior high, maybe early high school, and if they still have interest in these movies, inevitably they gravitate toward Han Solo, who fundamentally is good in the same way Luke Skywalker is, but, you know, Han Solo is a smuggler and a criminal, and he kills people without asking questions, and he seems dangerous, which is how a lot of junior high kids and young teenagers want to feel. They want to feel like good people who others see as dangerous. But then you become an adult, you know, maybe 10 years pass. And if you see the films again, you know, they seem totally different. And suddenly the essential character seems to be Darth Vader, and that's almost the character you relate to most. And what really has happened is that character who, you know, you might describe him to other people as more interesting, but the word you're really using probably and just replacing is the word authentic. It seems more real. The idea of Luke Skywalker seems fake. That we, you know, the idea of being heroic seems like an aspirational thing only a child would kind of would cling to. But as an adult, we know that we are capable of problematic things. And really, just ethics and morals are keeping us in line. The ideas are there in our mind. So you see someone like Darth Vader, and you're like, well, you know, the way he was raised impacted him. The scenario he was in impacted him. It was all these social issues, you know?
I had just read that part of the book last week, and somebody had sent me on my Facebook page, and I this is why I love slash hate the internet. But I look down and there's a 1970s Underoos commercial for Boba Fett Underoos. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And it's a hilarious commercial. It's 30 seconds long. But I thought about that of, oh, okay. But, you know, did we have Darth Vader Underoos and would we today?
Well, we definitely would today. I bet they even did then.
Yeah.
You know, like the idea of Boba Fett underoos is kind of funny in its own way. It's sort of like, you know, the kid wants to be a unsuccessful bounty hunter.
Right. I mean,
that's a strange aspiration to have. But, you know, this has come up before when I've done interviews for this book. Very often people, especially people with kids, will bring up the idea of what is the social consequence of creating toys of villains? You know, like if a kid, you know, loves to play with a Darth Vader doll, and that's his favorite character, and when he plays with those action figures, he wants to be Darth Vader. What does that mean? And I think that a lot of parents see it meaning something troubling that was done by society, that somehow society has confused the kid into not seeing the difference. But I don't know if that's what it is.
And it's really no different than wanting to be dressing up on Halloween as an evil character, right? As a monster?
Well, you know, that's the monsters are different, though. I know this is going to seem like a subtle distinction, but there's a pretty big difference between monsters and villains. Monsters inevitably are monsters against their will. You know, Godzilla,
right,
created by nuclear weapons. Frankenstein built by a doctor. Vampire Bit was once a normal person. Werewolf Bit, you know, becomes a werewolf. And if you've talked to someone who loves monster movies, it's pretty rare that they're like, I love it when Godzilla gets killed. They tend to be very sympathetic toward the monsters. But villains are different. Villains are people who we're supposed to feel guilty about if we sympathize with them, almost to trick us into having empathy for someone we know that intellectually we're supposed to be against, and that gives this narrative we've created weight. It sort of makes the character seem more full.
When you I want to go back for a moment to your role as the ethicist for the New York Times Magazine, is that a job that you enjoy, and what are the challenges in doing that week to week?
I definitely enjoy it. It's so unique. You know, I as an essayist, I often would find myself spending, you know, 5,000 words writing about Tim Tebow in order to get to a question about ethics,
right,
or you know, faith, or, you know, or I'd read a long piece about a band like Nickelback to sort of deal with this idea of when's it acceptable to arbitrarily hate something. The ethicist really boils it down to the problem. The problem is right up front. It feels like, on one hand, I realize it's just a newspaper column. It's not like, you know, my advice has any kind of moral weight outside of myself. But you want to be right. You know, you want to create an argument. You're picking a question that seems like it's 50-50, that you know you can make a reasonable argument on either side. You want to kind of craft something that basically persuades people that this is how a rational, ethical person would deal with it, you know.
Well, it's fascinating stuff, certainly in that column and also in the book, I Wear the Black Hat. It's now out in paperback from Scribner. Chuck Lusterman, thank you very much for being with us. Always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for having me on, man.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, I Wear the Black Hat. It's published by Scribner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.